Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet Jack Hopper. For over 50 years, Hopper has been an editor of both scholarly and fiction texts. In addition to poetry, he writes plays and short stories. He is one of the three founding editors of Cuga Lake Books, a regional publishing company. And he is the author of four collections of poetry, including his most recent, called Rafting the Medusa, published this spring by Cuga Lake Books. Hopper served for two terms as Poet Laureate of Tompkins County, New York. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
The new collection goes from 2013 until early of this year, 2018.
Right.
Was there a general theme, or were you just collecting the stuff that you'd been writing for?
I was collecting stuff. It's like whatever rolls to the bottom of the hill, and there was more of it this time. So suddenly, in a period of only about 5 years,
yeah,
there was quite a bit. I could actually throw some things away, which is healthy.
But you didn't discover any kind of a theme. You know, these poems to me seem a little bit more intimate, a little bit more about memory.
I did because since I moved up here in 2005, my wife had died just before that, and then my mother came up for the last 5 years of her life, died at 100.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, all the biggies in the family are gone, you know? And there's a kind of liberating thing about it, which is perhaps a strange thing to admit, but it's true, certainly for writers, I think.
Yeah.
It's sort of, now I can talk about them.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I don't love them less, but I can talk about things like racism, and some of the poems deal with that.
Yeah.
And just the kind of people they were.
You know, I can understand that being free to talk about somebody, because it's keeping them alive in some way, small kind of way.
Right, yeah.
So your title, Rafting the Medusa, tell us what that means to you. Where'd you come up with the title?
There's a great big painting in the Louvre called The Raft of the Medusa by Géricault.
Oh.
And it deals with a real fact. There was a ship, a French passenger ship of some sort, in 1818, I think, or something like that, went down off the coast of Africa, all hands practically, but a few made it on this kind of makeshift raft. And most of them died. And all kinds of terrible things probably happened, as do on these adventures, cannibalism, who knows. And so finally a ship actually came and saved the few that were left. But it's a horrendous painting. It's huge, as they were in those days. And it's reflected in my poem, because we used to have a place in the Neshaminy River in Bucks County in Pennsylvania. Uh-huh. And my mother and her brother actually decided, once when my father was not around, to take down the barn door and use it as a raft.
Oh, my God.
And on we went, and down the creek, and then finally back again. And looking back on those wonderful, wonderful childhood days, I must have been about 5 years old or something like that, there it was. There was life. You know, we're still going up and down the river there.
That's interesting. Yeah. So you feel that now. I mean, you're writing a lot still.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And so
sure.
Does poetry feel like life to you? And you're glad
Absolutely.
You must be writing
yeah.
so
yeah.
much, yeah.
I could imagine being without it, you know.
Yeah.
Like a musician, he's got to reach for his axe, you know. He's got to play it.
Yeah.
Or his fingers get soft.
You know, a lot of the work in this book is about memory. Do you think that comes from age more so? Or, you know, poets are famous for writing about memory, but I say all of us who are a little bit older seem to be going back and trying to recapture.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily connect it with age, but that certainly contributes to it. We go back and look at those comfort zones that we grew up with, and some of the nasty ones, too.
Yep.
And they're also very, very clear, and we're not necessarily fighting the present so much, because many of us are perhaps retired and don't have the same challenges. So there they are, and some of them are awfully good. People you haven't seen for ages. It's like going back to a reunion
yeah.
and actually liking it.
Yeah, and recapturing people who have died, giving them another chance at having a portrait in the world.
Even people very close, like I didn't pay much attention to my father, and he died, he was only 63 when he died.
Wow.
And which was like awful. And then he was gone for all those years. And all of a sudden, in this book, There are two poems that deal with him, and in a very nice, very, very lovely way. There was another side to him that I had sort of brushed away, blew him away.
Yeah.
And yet he's coming back, you know. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful to be able to recapture some parts of your life. Now, I want to have you read the title poem, Rafting the Medusa.
Oh, yeah, sure.
To tell us a tiny bit about it before you start.
Well, it deals with this, it deals with the actual event of pulling down this creek, which was about 6-7 feet deep, and I couldn't swim.
Oh, my God.
My mother could, her brother couldn't. But So, but then the second part of the poem, the longer part, deals actually with it's a kind of metaphor for our going through life, navigating all the shoals and so forth, and trying to get back home.
Ah.
And that's where it goes toward the end. And how will we know that, you know? So here it is, Rafty the Medusa. There's a little epigraph ascribed to Leonardo da Vinci that goes, "Tell me if anything was ever done. My mother put me on a makeshift raft, propelled us down a swollen creek, our goal a distant highway bridge, without considering how currents often play one way. Along we floated till the shadow of that overpass darkened, and our fight to return began as mother plied the pole, now upstream and against the flow. The wooden raft's long dead, and so is she, with mates of mine gone too. I'm not alone, pulling against the currents on my own craft. I have drifted down the river Alf, conversed with Mr. Kurtz about the horrors of 100 years, and am still unsure if I will ever make it back against the flow, the depth that's deepened, the others clinging to our bark, or recognize my place of first departure, and who may be on shore waving us home."
Oh, I love that ending.
Thank you.
Endings make it for me with some
poems.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask you about this. You were poet laureate for 2 years. What was that experience like for you?
It was great. I had no idea what I was facing, although you were helpful at one point in the beginning. What do I do?
Yeah.
And what I did was very enlightening and opening for me. It opened me up. I'm not a joiner. So it was getting me out of my cave was really an adventure.
Uh-huh.
And dealing especially with other older people and younger people too at places like Lifeline was just great, because some of them wrote a little bit, some a little more, and some not at all. And we had little sessions and discussed all kinds of poetry. I got them to write, and sometimes a first poem came out that was dynamite.
Oh, wow.
It was so great. It was great for them, and it was great for me, too. We were all involved in this birth. You know?
That's so great. Isn't it fun and just amazing to watch people bring out creativity they didn't know they had?
Exactly.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, did being poet laureate stifle your creativity or make it better, or were you preoccupied?
Sometimes it cut into my time, but then that happens with anything, you know. But it fed it eventually, and it was some absolutely beautiful moments that made it all worth it. One very quick one, I remember I was reading the Buffalo books, and it was a pretty good crowd. There was a young guy there, I think he was a student, and I read this poem about my mother called The First 100 Years, which was in my third book, Doubles. And it's got great lines in it, you know, about the only walker that she liked was Johnny's.
Oh, yeah.
that kind of thing. But the whole thing was just this wonderful woman in her last year and then finally drifting off into death. But it had a humorous, it was her life. Her whole positive life was reflected in it. And when it was over, this young guy said, he says, "I don't write poetry. I don't even read it." He says, "But this reminds me exactly of my mother."
Wow.
And I lit up like a bulb. I just felt so good. A few watts came transfusing through.
Oh, I'll bet.
It was worth it.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Reaching somebody on that kind of a level is
exactly.
So amazing.
Yeah. One person, hey.
Yeah. Oh, God. So I want to talk to you about this, too. You were one of the editors of Cuga Lake Books.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering what you look for when you read other people's work, especially in regard to publishing it.
Yeah. You don't look for anything. I've had a lot of experience in this. I edited a magazine for several years down in New York, and I've been editing anyway. So you get a feel for something almost, if it's a short story, the first page or two, they'll tell you yes or no.
Oh, I'll bet.
But sometimes there are things that if you go a little farther, you know, there's something here. You need some patience. And this is it's a local press, so you have a little bit more leeway, too, about reading other people's work, you know, giving them a little room.
Uh-huh.
It's been a very, very rewarding experience, I think.
Oh, I'll bet. Do you ever give people personal advice or, you know, write to them and say,
lot,
this
yeah.
looks good, but it needs polish and
sure.
that kind of thing?
We have a rule that we all, four of us now, actually have to agree on accepting a work. Without that we won't do it. So very often, if there's something that I liked and the others didn't, I'll take the person aside and say, hey, I'll walk you through it, you know? and show you what to do, how to actually physically prepare the manuscript for the printer and so forth.
Wow.
And it's a big technical thing that usually most people don't know unless they're involved in that sort of thing.
Yeah. Oh, so it must be gratifying, though.
It is.
To be able to bring people's work out, even with a small press, you know?
Oh, sure, yeah. And this place, my gosh, it's a treasure trove of writers.
Oh, I know. But you've published some people who'd never been published before.
Exactly.
Which that's one of the gifts that I think small presses do for people.
Indeed.
I want to have you read another from Rafting the Medusa. This one is titled As If.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's really a poem about writing, and it's something that writers don't like to do. They don't like to write about writing, but they can't escape it because it's them.
Yep.
You know? As if. Clutching a pen as if it could spring light and illuminate a line, I listen for the right word, hoping I have an ear to hear it. Outside, no sound, no passing plow, no shovels shoveling snow, only the hill, waiting to echo something I'm expected to say, and batteries of crows gathering as if to challenge questions I've yet to ask.
I love that last line. I really do. You know, people are often interested in the creative process. Now, you've been writing for many decades. Has your focus in way of approaching the poem changed at all through all these years?
No. More the thing that's changed for me is the way I approach writing, not so much the theme. The theme comes from very often from my own past. I'm not so political, so it's not that way. Everybody has their own strength and weakness, I guess. But I've changed my way of. When I first started, I was very opaque. Robert Bly once describes one of my poems that I had submitted as it's too opaque, and I've never forgotten that. And he was true. I was sort of hiding aspects of myself or of the poem itself, and as I've gotten older, I was saying, "Hey, the heck with that! You know, let's get it all out there."
Yeah.
So, and in doing that, I've loosened up the poetry, the language itself. I've taken it away from the modernist urge of two poets, for example, like Pound and Eliot, who I like very much, or William Carlos Williams, and I still like their work. But what they did to poetry was lessen the number of readers.
People are
saying, you know, it's not my game anymore. They don't want that. They say we'll write for each other almost.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to take my stuff away from that and making it more accessible. And that's the key, I think, for me.
Yeah, you know, I think it's amazing when you say you were kind of hiding in your writing.
Yeah,
that seems remarkable that you'd be writing something that you know is going to go public, that you oftentimes read in front of a group of people, but you're trying to hide still.
Yeah,
behind that language.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Jack Hopper, and we're talking about his new collection, Rafting the Medusa. You've been here in Ithaca since 2005.
Yeah.
Tell us your feeling about the city, how the town and culture has shaped you as a creative person.
I came up here knowing really only one person, I think, and that was Fred Wilcox, who fortunately knew everybody else. I called him the unofficial mayor of Ithaca. I walk along the block with him every fifth step, it seems, that he knew somebody. But he introduced me to several people, and that spread and spread. I've never met as many people in a short period of time whom I liked and who seemed to like me. I lived for 25 years then in the suburbs of New York, and I can't remember anybody that of note to me, you know, or that returned a gesture of friendship. It was just, I came up here, it was happening all the time.
And you know what? The criterion is you have to be creative.
I think that helps.
You know what I mean?
Indeed, yeah.
Not really, but I mean, this town is very friendly.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
But there are so many places where you can fit in if you're a musician or a writer. Or, you know, even a cook.
Well, there's so much going on. It's really a mini Manhattan, you know. It's just you have the first right to refuse. We lived in Brooklyn for another 25 years when I first got married down there, and we'd go home and stay home, but here, the pool is there all the time to get you to come out. There's something at Cornell. There's something at Ithaca College.
Yeah.
There's something right on the Commons. There's Friday night galleries. There's the whole thing.
Oh, absolutely.
It's inescapable.
And I've heard that Brooklyn has changed.
Yeah, it has.
You know.
Quite a bit.
A lot more, like a small town.
It's much like this place in a way.
Uh-huh.
The expression is you can't spit without hitting a poet. I think there's something to it.
Oh, God. Now, that is gross.
Yeah, it is. Too many poets.
No, never, never. This culture needs poetry.
No, oh, sure.
It needs thoughtful people writing about the state of the world, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you noted in your bio that I got that you're working on a fictional memoir. I'd never heard that term. What does that mean? I mean, we know a lot of movie stars and people lie in their memoirs, but what does this mean?
I wrote about 10 chapters of a thing. Mainly, it was centered on my mother, because she lived here for 5 years, and I got to know her in a way more than I did the other 95, or whatever it was, it seems. And here I was, you know, was I going to write about her? Well, it expanded to the family itself, it expanded to me, to certain adventures. And I showed it to a friend of mine who was an agent in New York, who used to work for me, actually. And he said, nobody's publishing memoirs anymore, which is not true.
No, it's not.
They're still coming thick and fast. But he says, if you turn this into a novel, he says, I will represent you. So that was it's a tremendous challenge, and that was several years ago, and I'm still wrestling with that.
Now, but what's the difference, though? I mean, between a novel,
you just take more adventures with them. I think you take more liberties, more freedoms with them,
and you add more adventurous remembrances and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm thinking, for example, of I've been toying with this idea for a long time of having a fictional brother. I never had a brother. I have a sister. And I'll make him the dark side of me, you know? All the things that maybe I didn't want to talk about over here, I'll let him do and let him have the fun.
Well, that's interesting. Do you think people will know the difference?
Oh, I think it'll be
some people go, oh, he's, you know.
I think it'll be transparent.
Oh, good.
I'm not really trying to hide it. It'll be fun.
No, I mean, I think that gives you a real field of creativity to
exactly.
be able to do it that way. Instead of going, today I went, you know.
Oh, sure.
The kind of thing with a memoir.
But with all the places that I have traveled and so forth, I can throw a lot into that soup, I think.
I'll bet you can. Now, I want to read you, I want you to read another piece from the book. It's called Paris Back in the Day.
Yeah.
To tell us a bit about this. I love this.
When I was in the Army, drafted in the Army back in 1957, I was sent by a stroke of magnificent luck to Paris, to 60 miles from Paris.
No.
And I was a passport carrier, which meant that I had to go every Friday with a bunch of passports and visas to the visa section in the embassy. And I'd stay over, of course. But then I went back after that was over as a civilian for another 2 years. So I knew some French when I got there, but there's no substitute to what you learn on the street.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
I found that, too.
That's the condition, almost.
Yep.
And this is one of the first places I actually... that's another poem, but this is what happened to me with the language itself, which is metaphorical of knowing a different country, listening to different opinions that were very different from American opinions, not unfriendly, but like, do you really believe in that?
Yeah.
Somebody would say.
Yep.
So that's what this is about. Paris back in the day. It's also about how one can... Somebody said to me recently, don't you want to go back to Paris to visit again? And I said, no, actually, I don't, because most of the people I knew back then are either gone away in one way or another. They're dead or they've moved or whatever. And I don't want to go back a stranger.
Yeah.
The only way I'll do it is if I'm with somebody who has not been there.
Yeah.
And to share with him or her, you know, that would be great.
Yeah, having to start over at this point.
There's a line in here that says that, but it's really worth discussing in itself. Paris, back in the day. One morning, you awoke and found you were speaking intimate French, were dreaming in it, so immersed in it that you fancied yourself Parisian. Its name-changing streets that were mysteries, whispered on maps, soon entered your veins, their distances shortened, their histories solved, burrowed into your brain. And the natives, who eyed you as foreign, began to ask you into their homes. In return, you led their daughters and sons to the Rue de l'Ancienne Comédie, up those left-bank winding stairs, a transit some call love's best part, turned by time into songs, by poets into lines of art. All gone, departed, as they call the dead. You can go back there, but not back then. Even as you savored it, it was passing you by. Friends came, friends went, as did you, indifferent as tides that tug and swell the ocean, as capillary springs that rush and move the rivers, slipping into the flow, You'd be lying to deny that aging grows hateful to yourself. Losses endured, friends taken, yet time casts up its gifts, and you give thanks.
That's lovely. And I know what line you think we should discuss, that one you can't go back there.
Yeah, yeah.
You can go back there, but not back then.
Right.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The city doesn't change that much, but you change, and you're bringing your own set of changed personality to it.
Yeah.
And they're all new people, you know, and they have renamed a couple of streets, maybe.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it's not as intimate to you as it used to be.
Did you find that in real life? I mean, even when you go back to New York?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Right.
Does that make you sad?
It's humbling, but we need a great deal of that, I think. We're all full of our own life and our own selves, you know.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, there's this great big world outside. It's, you know, we're little ants.
Oh, yeah, I think it is helpful to poets.
Oh, yeah,
to be, you know, for us to be humbled every once in a while.
I think so.
By life or,
a bad review. Yeah. I know I need it.
to tell us who've been some of your influences through the years, poets that have spurred you on and influenced you.
Yeah, they change because you keep discovering them. I wasn't academically connected to, I was a history major, not an English major.
Uh-huh.
So I never went through that mill, you know. And it was only more recently and very sparsely along the way that I would read other poets. And I've read a great deal more in the last, say, 10 years when I've had time to do it, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not editing other people's works, but by working on my own. And some of the ones that came up have been people like Jack Gilbert, who's, I think he's wonderful. And he ducked. He would not join either. He lived on the Lower East Side on the same street I did, and I never met him.
Wow.
And when I found this out, I was, oh, gosh. I would.
You wrote a poem about him.
Yeah,
in the book.
I would have liked to have met him, you know, people like that.
Uh-huh.
That's one example. Oh, gosh, there's many, but I always forget them.
Are you attracted? Like, I met so many men who are a little bit older who love Jack Kerouac, Gregory Corso, you know, Ferlinghetti, the little trio of...
Sure. Well, they're all attractive, not always for their writing. There's something about their personality.
Yeah, especially Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah.
For me.
Right.
Yeah.
I never got to know Jack Spicer, for example.
Oh, yeah.
But he was in a bar that a lot of people went to in San Francisco, and I was living out there for a short while, called the Anxious Asp. I say that with great
fame. Yeah, you must say that quite deliberately.
Spicer would be up in the corner with a great bumper of brandy. And sort of holding forth, and he seemed kind of forbidding, but I liked his poetry because he took such wonderful chances, and
yeah.
That's what I liked about that crowd, the whole Beat thing. It's not that their work altogether was so wonderfully good or memorable, like a Carlos Williams or people like that. Maybe it won't last like that, but there was something in their life force.
Oh,
it comes through, it shines.
And some of Ginsberg stuff, it brings you back to the era, which,
yes.
You know, I was a little kid in the 50s and 60s, but
right.
it gives you a flavor that he wouldn't have if he hadn't captured
exactly.
it.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, my oldest brother turned me on to all these...
Oh, really?
All these poets, Gregory Corso and Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg.
Yeah.
And they have stayed with me.
Yes, they do.
They have stayed with me.
How do you shake a Kerouac?
You know, I don't hear that many women say that they're influenced by the Beat poets. It's mainly men who talk about being influenced.
Yeah, they are. And there's such good ones that have emerged in the last 50, 60 years. Really good, like from Denise Levertov way back.
Oh, yeah, Audrin Rich is one of my favorites, yeah.
Others that I can't, that I, of course, forget the names of.
Diane Wachowski.
Wachowski, yeah, I knew Wachowski way back. Yeah, she's good.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, mm. Yeah, but there are too many to name. I want to have you read a final poem from the collection. This one's called Countdown.
Countdown. Each year was a gift of life. His only fear was that he might misplace it and waste time to track it down, or worse, lose it and be unable ever to replace it. He could leave it on the top of his car while squeezing into the seat in a tight park and drive away. He could leave it at a subway booth while fumbling for change and only discovered its loss two stations later. People had returned such treasures and more so had saved him from losing belief in others. Life woke him every morning and he'd push the power button to be sure he was on. He'd resist as though getting up meant descending into the sewers of Warsaw to fight the Nazis, then finding that the only exit opened to a Jersey beach on the Atlantic Ocean with all his family, live and well, and daring the waves to knock them down.
I love that. That is so great. Tell us a little bit about where that came from. Obviously, it's part of memory and experience.
Yeah, it is. It's a similar thing. Waking up to me is an adventure. Like, oh my God, here I am. It's another day, and I'm alive. And that's wonderful to discover, especially when you know it. You know, so often we take things, especially life, for granted. Yeah, and I don't think I do that. I'm so happy. Sometimes you have to scuff yourself up a little bit to discover it, but you know.
Oh yeah, and then there are hard times, but it's still the thing called life. Yeah.
But that's sort of where this came from, this whole idea.
Well, you know, I want to ask you too. I wonder if you're somebody who also believes that reading poetry live is the best way to hear it.
I do, especially if the poet, him or herself, believes in the work. That's most important. Most people do it silently. They face the page, they write it down, you know, and they never think of it as the sound. And yet, of course, that's how it all began. It was all sung. It was lyric. Yeah. And that's the kind of poetry that I write is basically lyric poetry. And I think it's so important to hear the poet himself, the writer himself, for that matter, whoever, whatever form it is, hear them read it.
Yeah.
Where is their emphasis?
But what's your take on some of the poets who don't know how to read well? I've heard some poets ruin their work.
Yeah.
There are poets that I love.
I know. It's a shame because sometimes the work is good, but they put their head down. You know, they don't look at the audience. They swallow their words.
Yeah, they don't know how to phrase.
Part of it's maybe some training or paying attention to other poets who have read very well.
Yeah.
I think one of the apogees of that was Dylan Thomas.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
They said that his readings were so dynamically wonderful was because he tried to get himself back to the point where he had actually written the poem, that magical moment. It took maybe 16 bourbons to do it. That was his problem. But he did it. And I don't think we have to go to that extreme, you know, but there it is. If you could just get yourself in, where was I when this happened?
Yeah. Oh, I know. It is amazing. It's an amazing language. Well, we're almost out of time, Jack. Do you want to give some contact information? Tell us about any readings coming up in the next couple months.
Yeah, there'll be a reading mid-August, I think it is, out at the library in Trubensburg. And I know there's a lot of Ithacans at heart that will be coming to that who live out there, and others, of course, from here too. And I'm going to set some things up when probably in the fall, move around, hit a few libraries. Get into Buffalo Street Books. I haven't done that yet this time around.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I'll hand them some contact information.
I have a website, and it's johnhopperauthor.com.
johnhopperauthor.com.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that is terrific. Thank you so much for joining us, Jack. I think this is a wonderful collection. I really do.
Thank you.
And we need voices out there speaking and speaking to each other, you know, people speaking.
I do agree.
In this
And
culture.
My pleasure is sitting here seeing you.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it is good to be back.
Great.
I've been talking to Jack Hopper, and his new book is called Rafting the Medusa. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.